This country is at a crisis moment, and we're either going to tip forward into a new future where we keep moving forward on civil rights, equal rights, justice, fairness, or we tip back.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook.
Emily's List has been doing this work recruiting and supporting women candidates for over three decades. We've never seen anything like this.
That's Stephanie Shriok. She's the president of Emily's List, the political action committee that supports pro-choice, democratic female candidates for elected office. And in a year where the political conversation has been dominated by women,
dramatic rise in the number of women signing up for political training.
Stephanie has brought the group's efforts to new heights. But now, she says her goal is to put Emily's List out of business.
I'm hoping that we are on a path that we're no longer needed. Yeah, like someday Emily's List will not be needed because there will be women running in every election out there. I mean, there should be.
Stephanie has spent her entire career in the political arena. In 2004, she was Howard Dean's national finance director. Later, she was Montana Senator John Tester's chief of staff. And in 2009, she was the campaign manager to Senator Al Franken, who recently resigned after allegations of sexual misconduct. We spoke with Stephanie about her extensive experience in Washington, including her work with Franken. We dove deep into her history in politics, which started back in a Montana mining town. And we discuss the future of Emily's List and the hopes she has for women in public office. Stay tuned for our interview with Stephanie Shriok. On the podcast, we'll be bringing you real talk with women bosses, asking how did you make it and what advice you would give a woman looking to lead. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter at @apalmerdc. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. And now a word from our presenting sponsor, Chevron. When more girls go into science, technology, engineering, and math, the whole world benefits. With support from families, schools, policymakers, and businesses, girls can do remarkable things with STEM. Chevron is proud to join Women Rule in empowering the next generation of female leaders. And now our interview with Stephanie. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today. We are in the middle of a moment right now. There are more women running for office. You told me a few months ago that you thought the past 33 years of Emily's List have been leading up to this election. Some are calling it the year of the woman again. What do you think is going on?
I think we're at a tipping point. I think that it is clear that this country is at a crisis moment, and we're either going to tip forward into a new future where, you know, one, we keep moving forward on civil rights, equal rights, justice, fairness, or we tip back. And we could tip back by decades, which should be so devastating, particularly to women and families. And so I believe that women, as soon as the 2016 election of Donald Trump came to pass, and when I say as soon, I mean the next morning, there was an instant desire to first resist and then take positive action moving forward. And that's where we are.
And do you see this mostly as a reaction to the president and his policies, or is there something else happening?
Well, I think along the way, there's been different motivating moments. But when I think about that first day, which is hard for me to think about because you can imagine at Emily's List, the day after the 2016 election was not really an uplifting day over here. We were devastated. And so there was going to be an emotional outburst of energy that was going to be positive. And that happened. It just happened for the wrong reason. It happened when Donald Trump won. And I think that was, you know, that was really the beginning of it. It was, wait a second, I wanted to see my dream fulfilled in Hillary Clinton. And that did not happen. and she lost to that guy. That guy! We have to do something. And so every step of the way, there's been a motivating factor, whether it's the Women's March or the fight against Betsy DeVos or the energy around saving the Affordable Care Act, the Virginia elections in November 17, every moment along the way, and let us not forget the power of the Me Too movement as part of that, has continued that momentum.
So what at Emily's List are you doing to try to harness this momentum, this kind of action that you're seeing, this call to action across the country?
Well, it started immediately, and it even started before Emily's List was ready. And I'll be very honest about that. As I said, you know, we were a little down in the dumps after the election, and so much so that, you know, we were continuing sort of cleaning up as we do after every election. And one of my younger staff was doing some work and realized we were getting these phone calls, cold calls in Emily's List of women who wanted to run for office. Now, I know that sounds like a normal thing that would happen at Emily's List, but we've spent three decades begging women to run for office, to go out, sit at their kitchen tables and recruit and ask and support. But here there's this like number of women calling. And Regina's like, I wonder if this is happening on the website. And so she goes to the website. She finds this old link that I'm not even sure I knew existed anymore that basically said, hey, I'm thinking about running for office. Let me know when there's a training nearby. In the first 4 weeks after that election, over 1,000 women across this country had clicked that link. Now, just to give you comparison, the entire 2 years before the 15 and 16 election, we talked to about 920 women. So it was more of, hey, we're here and we're coming, wake up. And Emily's List is like, okay, we woke up fast. And at that point, we started building out our Run to Win program, which was a real call to action across the country of having women make a choice. You either got to run for office or you got to help a woman run for office. And that has really resulted in huge, huge numbers of women raising their hand and saying, I'm ready to do this. And so much so that we have now surpassed 26,000 women in that time period, all 50 states, young and old, different races, different economic backgrounds, as I said, different geographies. This isn't just the candidates for 2018. This is the next decade of leadership in this country.
Do you think, I mean, that must have helped you a little bit. I mean, you'd been campaigning so hard for Hillary Clinton that the loss was devastating. I mean, kind of to get not just yourself, but the team in general kind of out of that depression of, wow, I can't believe this actually happened.
The grassroots energy of women across the country have been our saviors at Emily's List and for our members and for our donors across the country, many of which who have been doing this for three decades as well. They needed some hope, and that hope came, and it came from women in these communities standing up. And I think the biggest shift for us, and I think not just for us, but for so many women across the country, was the Women's March of January of last year, a moment where, like, we weren't sure, like, how big was it going to be? How many people were going to show up? We had no idea how many hundreds of thousands of women and good men who stood with us were coming to Washington, D.C. But what was even more surprising and uplifting were all these little marches that weren't so little. The 10,000 that showed up in my home state of Montana in Helena. 10,000 in Helena. I mean, this happened over and over again. That moment, I think, really brought us some clarity here, because what we saw was not only women stepping out of their house in sometimes communities that were very red and saying, this is not the country I want, and I'm going to have my voice heard. And so I would say this, as we're a year out, for those who asked me a year ago, is this just a one-day event? Was this going to last? I would say we have proven month after month that it's not only lasting, it is building.
So a big part of what Emily's List does is raise money for Democrats. You talked about the donors who've been doing this for three decades. You raised $90 million in the presidential election, obviously focusing a lot on Hillary Clinton, but also some of the down ballot races as well in the Senate and the House. Where do you think you'll end up in this cycle? Have you seen the money come in? Are our donors still kind of depressed about the election?
Well, it starts with the grassroots donors, you know, and in Emily's list, so much of our support comes from the small dollar donor community. And that has been on fire in the last year. The generosity of those who can make a $25, $50, $100 contribution has been overwhelming. And it's helped us because, as I said, we have all these women who want to run for office, which means we've needed to expand the organization just a little bit. In fact, we doubled the size of our state and local team. We're still adding folks onto that team. We've nearly tripled the size of our digital team to ensure that we're talking to women all across the country, even if we can't physically get to, say, Alaska yet. Someday we will be there in a much bigger way. But we still want to communicate with those women. So we've really had to build out. So that has been generous support. And our major donor community, that was definitely sort of emotionally hit very, very hard. They have really come back because of the hope of Emily's list and these women candidates. And I've watched it over the year, like over the last 12 months. You know, folks were like, Stephanie, I just can't talk to you right now. I need time. To the summer going, so what's going on with all these women? To November and December, particularly around those Virginia elections and even the Alabama Senate race, though Doug Jones is not an Emily's List candidate, the energy of Democrats behind him has really was provided, as I said, the hope that folks needed, and also the motivation to get back engaged.
So raising money is one of the biggest barriers when we talk to women candidates all the time about whether they're going to run or not, having to ask for money. No one likes to do that. You do it a lot with big donors, with small donors. What's your piece of advice or is this kind of the secret sauce when it comes to, you know, having to put your hand out?
The truth is you just have to remember that it's really not about you as an individual running for office. It is about an investment in a better future. It's about an investment in building a better future for your community. And so I say to our candidates, you got to think about that story. And if you can take it from that aspect, I hope it's a little bit easier to make that ask. And then you got to ask because this is important. And folks, as I often say, let the donor or potential donor decide. It's okay if it's a no. It might just be a no for now. It could be a yes 2 months from now. Let folks make a decision of their involvement. Give them the opportunity to engage, including with their financial support.
So let's take a step back. You grew up in Montana, as you said earlier, in Butte, a mining town. How did your kind of childhood prepare you for a career in politics?
Well, I was definitely stewed in the union politics of Butte, Montana. I think about, you know, what that mine meant. It's a copper mining town. And in fact, I often tell folks that most of the copper wire that has been laid in the East Coast for all those phones long ago when you had those hardline phones, that most of that copper came out of the mountain of Butte, Montana. The Anaconda Copper Mine and Company drove a lot of copper out and a lot of politics early on. And that meant that you needed to have workers organized, and that was a union town. I mean, it was really a union town. In fact, I remember when the McDonald's came in because we didn't even like those kind of companies coming into Butte. And I know I'm older than I used to be, but I'm not that old to remember that kind of thing. So that was just the environment we were in. And my dad worked at the hospital, and my mom was a librarian. So we weren't necessarily, you know, directly related to the mine, but didn't matter. Everybody in that town sort of made a choice. You were either with the management of the company or you were with the workers of the mine. And when there was a strike, as there was in the early 80s, you know, we made a choice, you know, and our choice was, of course, we're going to be with the workers so they have better conditions and better pay. And that meant supporting those families when they weren't working during that strike.
And even in high school, that's kind of where you got your first start in running campaigns, because before you were at Emily's List, you were in the campaign business. But that started earlier than most. Talk to us a little bit about that, how you kind of did that help formulate, you know, how you decided to run races as more of a staffer.
That's very funny. Okay, so I was that kid. And I'm just going to say it now. I was that kid in high school because I wanted to be engaged. I wanted to serve. And so I ran for class. I was the candidate running for class president a number of times. Let me just be blunt. I lost a number of times. And finally, I realized going into my senior year when I was a junior that if I ran for student body president, the whole school voted instead of just my class. And that if I ran a campaign focused on the expanded electorate of freshmen and sophomores, I'd have a chance. This might be why I became a staffer on campaigns and not in front. And that's exactly what I did. And I, in fact, got a younger sister of one of my opponents to endorse my candidacy.
Wow.
Very powerful, you know, and ended up winning that election for student body president, which was a great honor to serve and do that. And I learned a lot in the process. But that was sort of my beginnings. And I volunteered for the local Democrats.
Talk about that. I mean, you did a lot of campaigns through the years. There isn't a lot of job certainty there. And oftentimes you pick up, you're driving across the country over and over again. What advice do you have for the women who are listening to this, who are considering making that kind of a career choice where you might not know where your next paycheck's going to come?
Yeah, that is very true. I definitely had some moments where it was tight living in between jobs. But what I would say for those who are thinking about it, if you can financially do it, and I know that can be a strain, but if you can do it, it is worth it. I mean, one, you meet the most amazing people who are hunkered down with you in these major campaigns. And you know, it's like a startup. All of the stress of setting up a business from scratch. I mean, you don't have a legal. You got to build your legal apparatus. You got to raise the money. You got to build the staff. You got to build the plan. I mean, it is a startup. But it is a startup that has like a one-day sale out, close-out sale on election day. Right. Like that's it. That's the short period of time. If you can pull that off, what you learn and the people you meet is worth every bit of it. And I'm so grateful for all of the steps along the way. So if you can do it and pick up, I would say one, don't ever buy a lot of furniture. Make sure you fit in one car. That has helped me immensely over the years for a long time. Two, say yes if you got an opportunity that comes up, including in the middle of the campaign. You know, if you're trying to learn about different aspects of the campaign, say yes. Just take it. One of the things that helped me, I learned early. Fundraisers are often first hired and last let go because you need money to start and you need money to close down. So for slightly better career financial situations, fundraising, not a bad direction to go. They will get, I know comms directors are going to be mad at me right now, but there is slightly more stability on the fundraising side, which honestly was literally the reason I chose to do fundraising. It wasn't like I was driven to be a fundraiser, but I was like, huh, I going to get a job now as a finance director or I have to wait 3 months for something? I got to get paid.
I've never quite heard this before. This is a piece of advice. But
this is a little, you know, and we always need fundraisers. We need all those folks, obviously. But that for me was one of the reasons. Now, I always wanted to get into management and ultimately did become a campaign manager, as you know. But that was honestly my beginning and why I did it.
That's great. We'll be right back with more Women Rule. But first, a word from our presenting sponsor, Chevron. When more girls go into science, technology, engineering, and math, the whole world benefits. With support from families, schools, policymakers, and businesses, girls can do remarkable things with STEM. Chevron is proud to join Women Rule in empowering the next generation of female leaders. Well, talk to me about this. I mean, you worked for Howard Dean, you worked for John Tester, you worked for Al Franken. You know, you now are kind of the face of the women's movement in a lot of ways. How was that transition? I mean, you talked a little bit about your kind of mentor, but I mean, was it ever awkward to kind of, as you made that transition into this very public-facing kind of position?
Well, the public-facing piece, that was a big transition. You know, the management, the planning, the strategic thinking of where to take Emily's List, I was ready and excited for. But I had to – the truth is I had to learn how to do the TV piece, you know, how to be the public face. And what I say to our candidates all the time who have never done that is it's learnable. You know, you get some good staff, you get some media training, you just practice just like anything else. You practice, you can do this. Everybody brings their own particular skills to a job. Then you learn the rest. And that's really important. And that for me, not only was a good reminder and lesson, but something that I share. There isn't a recruitment call that I take that I don't talk about that piece of even my career step, because it was a big step for me.
Well, and it'd be kind of focusing on women's issues. That hadn't been your career focus, right?
Yeah, I really focused on Democrats. Though I will say, my very first paying job in politics was for this wonderful, wonderful woman, professor at Winona State University at the time, Mary Reeder. She was running for Congress in what was then the first congressional district of Minnesota. This is the district I went to college in. So I went to college at what was then known as Mankato State University. It's now Minnesota State. I was Mankato back then. Now I'm really aging myself. And I went out and worked for her as a finance director, actually. Funny story. I didn't actually go out to be a finance director. I convinced her to be the scheduler because I thought, what a great job. I could learn all the aspects of the campaign. I'd right. work with everybody. I got there and they had just let go of their finance director. And I had done, this is a good lesson for everybody. I'd done one internship at an organization here in Washington, D.C. in a development department. And that one internship was enough for them to say, why don't you be the finance director? Which I had no idea what I was doing. But I said yes, back to take the risk and could say yes. And she was a pro-choice Democratic woman, hadn't received the endorsement of Emily's List yet, but was working directly with the Emily's List staff. And one of their finance advisors flew out to Minnesota, sat down with this scrappy kid who didn't know what she was doing, and taught me how to fundraise, and that was Mary Jane Volk, who's been with us for a long time, and was with us for a long time, just really great. And so I tell that story because I'm like, that really was my start, and it came through the doors of Emily's List. That was my first race.
Wow, comes full circle.
Is that right? That was a good investment on their part, I think. Yeah, ultimately, exactly. Better than they had anticipated. But you're right. I worked for all these really great men that I'm so honored to have worked for. And so as I was serving as Senator Tester's chief of staff, still at a time where there weren't that many women chiefs, there were more women chiefs than there were women senators. I will say that. But I remember very vividly, particularly as we were having the debate on the Affordable Care Act, and two things happened there that really was sort of my awakening. And I'd like to say I had an awakening in my 20s, and that was not the case. It happened in my 30s. And the awakening was this. First, we were having this debate on whether or not maternity was going to be covered, right? That was a big, big deal. I did not realize that so many women in this country had health insurance without maternity coverage attached. I thought that that was just the case, but it wasn't. And my sister-in-law, who happened to have gotten pregnant during that time period, had an insurance policy that did not have maternity coverage. And then she got pregnant with my fabulous nephew, didn't have coverage, couldn't get it because she had a pre-existing condition called pregnancy. And that little guy, everything's fine now, but had a slightly difficult delivery, C-section. And as my brother said, it's like buying a little car. All of a sudden, my family had, a 10,000 plus debt on a baby delivery because they couldn't get insurance. And so this real moment of like, this was happening. And now we're seeing this fight. And Senator Debbie Stabenow, you know, sitting in that finance committee hearing, looking at then Arizona Senator John Kyle, who was like, we don't need to cover maternity because I don't need it. And she was there to say, but your mom did. And that was the turning moment. And I thought, my goodness, like I love John Tester and he does a fabulous, fabulous job and we need him there. But what if Debbie Stabenow weren't sitting there? What if there was not a woman in that committee, which was the case 20 years prior? And for me, that was my awakening of I gotta do something, and had this immense opportunity here at Emily's List to do something about it. And the truth is, those Democratic men, they're with us on this too. They know we get better policies when there are more women at the table. And ultimately, we're going to have an equal number of women at the table as men.
So this is a good transition into, obviously, there's a lot of the talk about Me Too movement, the Time's Up, new movement that's kind of been going forward now. You know, as a woman working in politics, you talk about you were able to have all these advancements that maybe, you know, standing on the shoulders of those who came before you. But have you been surprised by how prevalent sexual harassment is on the Hill and on these campaigns? Or is this something that you think has just been kind of underneath the surface for a while?
Oh, I think it's, yes, it's been underneath the surface. And it's time to have a real conversation about this. I mean, do I think it is as bad as it was, you know, in the 70s? There's just more women. Thankfully, there are more women in all these areas. So I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is this. We have to have a real national discussion about getting through this moment. And Me Too ignited that conversation. And when I think about, you know, Senator Gillibrand and Congresswoman Jackie Speier from California, you know, putting legislation forth to make some changes. We have to make changes. We can't just have this moment and have this conversation and not result in ensuring that women and men are safe in their workplace and can be productive. So there's due process, but we come up with a way to protect women and men in those environments, but also a cultural change to say, okay, no more of this bad behavior.
You ran Senator Al Franken's 2008 campaign. I've been close with him. It's well known. You recently said that he did the right thing by stepping down. Just explain what you meant by that.
Well, as I've said and believe, I think Senator Al Franken has been a phenomenal senator for the state of Minnesota, and he cares deeply about Minnesota. And so when the moment came where dozens of his colleagues stood up and said, enough's enough, and he realized he could not do his job anymore for the people, he was going to do the right thing. And that's what he did. Doesn't mean that wasn't painful. It's hard to, you know, go through that moment without finishing the due process that was set up in the Senate Ethics Committee. And I think we all need to think about how we proceed from here. What are those processes for folks? But at the end of the day, for Al Franken, like if he couldn't do his job, he was going to step away so somebody could, because he put the people first. And I think that's, you know, I admirable, frankly. But as we move forward, I think it's really, really important that we don't just let this be one story, one more story. What we have to do is to say, this is the environment we want to live in. And there's certain behavior, you know, that's just, you know, maybe just bad behavior that we're just not going to accept anymore. And there's certain behavior that is purely harassment that makes the workplace intolerable, that is illegal. And we got to make sure we don't put up with that either.
How big of a motivating factor do you think that, I mean, you already had these big motivating factors that were happening kind of rippling through the past year. But do you think, have you seen an uptick since this whole Me Too movement and kind of has kind of been broken forward?
Yeah, it's such a good question because we were wondering that too. So this is with regard of how many women are signing up to run here at Emily's List. And it has been, there's been ebbs and flows. I will say it is every day. Like we don't go without a day where at least a handful of women don't sign up on that website. It's extraordinary, like, and sometimes a little daunting, to be honest with you. Like, here's another 25, you know, it's just, it's every day. And so, yes, I think the Me Too movement is a motivating factor. But I will share with you one of the biggest bumps we've had since the early moments, where the march was by far the biggest. But one of the biggest bumps we've had in the last, let's say, 4 months has been the November elections. So what happened the day after those big victories in Virginia, where, you know, Emily's List candidates ended up being 11 of those 15 Democratic pickups in the House of Delegates, where we, you know, we helped elect 13, you know, of our candidates, 13 of our 16 won. It was going to be 14 if not for a coin flip. I still can't get over that. That's how it works. But oh my gosh, that was really, really close. This is as close as you can get. After that moment, we saw another like mini explosion of signups. And it was triple or quadruple daily of what it was a week before. And that lasted for about 7 days, about a week after, where an additional 1,000 women signed up in a week after those Virginia elections, and not just Virginia, but those November elections. And I think what that's about is the recognition of, oh, wow, we could win. Like, I could win. This might be my time to step up and do this. That sets us up for a very strong 2018, where I think women candidates, with the backing of women organizers, women volunteers, and women voters, are going to change this election for the good.
So what's your prediction for 2018 in terms of the number of seats you think you could win? Do you think they can take back, Democrats can take back the House?
I absolutely think Democrats can take back the House. I think this is in play. I think we've got just extraordinary candidates in so many seats where we've got opportunities here. I mean, even just at Emily's List, just the woman's side of this picture, you know, we've launched women candidates in well over 50 House seats now, targeted House seats across the country. If you think about, you know, so we need 24. You think about those 23 House seats that Hillary Clinton won. You know, those are sort of the first go-to if you think about the map. We've got strong women candidates in 19 of those 23 already. Now, there's a lot of primaries. We're going to see, you know, how this flushes out. I think that's good. We've got a lot of green candidates who are getting less green by the second because they're raising money and they're talking to voters and they're doing the work they need to do. But I really feel like this is in play. I think the Senate, though with a much tougher map because there's so many Democrats up for reelection, particularly in states that Donald Trump won by double digits. That being said, after Alabama, I think it is at least a possibility, which before Alabama, I don't think I would have said that. It's good to see the energy building. But let's not just think about the congressional piece. I think this is important for everybody. There are dozens of governor's races up in 2018 and, of course, legislatures across the country. And this is where, you know, if this is an election where folks are really engaged, where the electorate is motivated, particularly on the Democratic side, which is what we're seeing, enthusiasm gap to the Democrats' benefit, you could see hundreds and hundreds of legislative seats flip in 2018, and we're recruiting across the board. So if that happens, we're hoping it'll be women leading the way.
So you came to Emily's List in 2010. I just want to end on, what's your legacy? What are you trying to build towards? Obviously, getting more women elected, but wanted to get your perspective on that.
Well, I would say this. I'm hoping that we are on a path that we're no longer needed. Yeah, like someday Emily's List will not be needed because there will be women running in every election out there. I mean, there should be now. I mean, we are 51.5-52% of the population. There's no reason why that's not the case. And the good news right now is that I think we're seeing a sea change. You know, as I said, Emily's List has been doing this work recruiting and supporting women candidates for over 3 decades. We've never seen anything like this, anything like this. And when I say this is the next decade of candidates, I believe it. And it's our job to ensure that's going to happen. And so as I think about my legacy of Emily's List, it is that we have expanded an organization first in memberships and grassroots support by building a organization that is 5 million strong of women and men who support this mission, but also to have not just historic numbers, because I would like to not have to say history anymore, that we break all the history and we break all the firsts and we just normalize what we're doing. That's what I'm hoping we get to.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Great. Thank you.